I'm very happy to be able to present to you my colleague and my friend, Professor Terence Frettheim, to be the Page Lecturer for 1991. Professor Frettheim has served on the faculty of Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota since 1968 as Professor of Old Testament. While there, he has also completed a 10-year term as Academic Dean. You will note from your program that Professor Frettheim has been involved in a number of activities, both professional and ministerial. He is an ordained minister in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and he has served his denomination faithfully both as a pastor and as a teacher. He holds membership in a variety of professional organizations. He is a member of the Catholic Biblical Association, also of the Society of Biblical Literature. This latter association he has served since 1983 as the Old Testament Book Review Editor for the Journal of Biblical Literature. From 1980 to 1988, he was also the editor for the Augsburg series of Old Testament books, a very fine series of books published by Augsburg Press. In the midst of these many activities, Professor Frettheim has been a prolific and a very distinguished author. You will note from your program that he has contributed numerous articles to professional journals and books and has himself authored some very important works. His two most recent works are the highly acclaimed The Suffering of God, an Old Testament Perspective, published by Fortress Press in 1984, and just this year, a commentary on Exodus in the Interpretation Series, which is published by John Knox Press. In a review of this work on Exodus, which appeared this summer, written by Walter Brueggemann, Brueggemann has described Frettheim's work as stunning, elegant, and daring. He has said that Professor Frettheim has provided us a work which at every turn shows things afresh, and which in the end provides imaginative materials which the preacher will not be able to resist. In this work on Exodus, Walter Brueggemann concludes that Terry Frettheim has emerged as arguably the most important theological interpreter of Scripture on the horizon. We are indeed grateful, Terry, for your willingness to come and share with us the fruits of your labor, the fruits of your passion for the work of the Hebrew Bible. And we thank you in advance for so graciously sharing with us your insight.
Thank you very much, Sam. I wish my mother were here. She could. President Drummond, faculty, students, it's good to be here. It's an honor to be on your campus and to be the Page Lecturer for this year. I just noticed this morning that the motto of your school, if that's not too light a word, motto, taking the word to the world, makes some important connections with our campus, our journal we call Word and World. So Baptists and Lutherans, I think, can speak to one another in important and helpful ways. I hope that conversation can be go on around here these next few hours and in the years and months to come. It's pleasant for me to be here for a number of reasons. This is the first time I've ever been in this part of the state of North Carolina, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to visit this fair state. I'm also pleased to be able to be here with Sam Ballantyne, one of my friends and one of the finest young Old Testament scholars at work in the United States today. And this also gives me an opportunity to talk about a topic of no little import for me, namely God's relationship to the creation. Particularly concerned, of course, about Old Testament resources for that topic. Now, we all have, instances where we say some things and we talk past one another, and we've all had the experience of someone taking away from a lecture or a conversation something that we never intended. I hope that doesn't happen here. I'm reminded of that professor who went out to a congregation and gave a lecture, and somebody came up afterward and said, "Say, that was superfluous, really superfluous." And the the prof rolled with the punches on that and said, oh, thank you very much. I appreciate your comment. You might like to know that I'm planning to have this lecture published posthumously. And to which the response was, say, that's great. The sooner the better. We can be talking past one another. I hope that doesn't happen during these days together. It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What matters finally is the kind of God in whom you believe. Or, to use different language, the images that we use to speak of God and to think about God will decisively determine the shape of our lives. All too often, the focus of the ministry of the church has been on whether one believes in God. And insufficient attention has been given to the kind of God in whom we believe, often with disastrous results. Witness any number of atrocities committed in the name of God by those who believe in God, from the Inquisition to Jonestown. The Old Testament tells us that the people of God were often guilty of worshiping idols, of making up their own God, of creating even Yahweh in a certain image. And we oversimplify this if we think of such images solely in terms of wood or stone. We have learned over the years that idolatries do not need the plastic form to be identified as such. One can move directly to verbal images, to mental images, which construct a false image of God and have the power to lead us away from the faith which is ours. One of the few artistic attempts to depict God, you no doubt remember this, Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel in Rome, that picture of God with that outstretched finger to the not yet created Adam. Now, if you were asked to paint a picture in some modern Sistine Chapel, a picture of God, what would emerge from your paintbrush? Stormin' Norman Schwarzkopf, maybe? The chairman of the board, Charles Atlas. A virile god, a macho god, certainly a male god. Or maybe we would go the route, a buddy-buddy god. My God and I walk through the fields together. We walk and talk as good friends used to do. How would you image God? A key question. I'm intrigued by these questions for a number of reasons. One has to do with my own upbringing. I'm a third generation pastor. My parents come from a branch of Lutheranism called Norwegian Pietism. And I can remember as a young child, the oldest of four boys, sitting around the family room every night after dinner, having devotions with one another, and reading the scriptures and praying together, and staying with me after all these years of that experience is the kind of image of God that my parents had and passed on to us. It's an image of God which God is one who so closely relates to the world. They presuppose a relationship between God and the human that is a genuine relationship. God and they were truly in conversation with one another. I swear God was right next door and the walls were paper thin. This had obviously a powerful impact on who I am and the faith that is mine. But one of the intriguing questions for me over the years since that experience is, how are piety and one's images of God related? Could one work back from certain types of piety to certain images of God? How central is the category of relationship in terms of the way one thinks about God? Another factor at work in this for me is as a teacher of the Old Testament. I'm concerned about the bad press which the God of the Old Testament has often received in the life of the church. I mean, the Old Testament God is often understood to be an authoritarian God, a distant God, a God of wrath, a God of law and judgment, a God of floods and fire and brimstone, holy wars, who strikes out in capricious, authoritarian, incomprehensible ways. I mean, how can you put up with a God like that? So it often rings, that's the God of the Old Testament. We need the God of the New. Jesus corrected the Old Testament at that point, so it is often said. I'm concerned about that bad press. Is that imaging of God really true to the Old Testament text? A third issue for me relates to the impact of our understanding of God on the mission of the church. I'm convinced that one of the key stumbling blocks to the mission of the church in our time is an understanding of God that's not very helpful in dealing with some of the difficult issues of life. I mean, you press people who are outside a religious community or even on the periphery of our own congregations, and it's surprising how often it is that a certain image of God is what keeps them away or makes religious faith difficult for them. Now, we could detail this in some ways in terms of a variety of issues, but one of the themes I've heard among a number from a number of pastors, from a number of lay people in the Lutheran Church. This may not be true of Baptists, but my guess is that there are some connections across these denominations at this point. And that is this, that the parishes of the church are filled with what's been called practical atheists. That very few people in the church, let alone those outside the church or on the edges of the church, have a sense for the presence and activity of God in their daily lives. The connections their lives have with God is very much a sometime thing, often associated only with a service of worship or perhaps an occasional dramatic moment in their lives. But ordinarily, God is not a factor to be reckoned with. God is just not a part of the daily picture. In the decisions that people make, in the relationships that they develop, in the jobs that they pursue, God could just as well be dead. I think it may be so that practical atheism is one of the chief religious problems in the churches today. Why? Why is this so? No doubt the factors are complex, but I would contend that one chief cause of this reality in the lives of the churches is that our message over the last few generations has been on the radical transcendence of God, the stress on the distance of God from the life of the world. And what needs renewed attention in our time is the relationship between God and the creation. I suppose if we were to go out among you here and ask for you to depict some relation, some image of the relationship between God and the world, we might come up with two or three, who knows how many images, but I would guess, just guess, that the most common image among us here today would be what I would call a double world image. God has his own world, which is other than this world. God is out of this world normally. And then the problem is to construct various images which seek to bring our world and God's world together. And so we sing, like, he's got the whole world in his hands. And in such an image, is it not so? God is really outside this world, and like some Charles Atlas or green giant, God holds the world up like a giant with a softball. And then we commonly move to a corollary of such image, that God must be in absolute control of everything. Or we take another route, that ordinarily God inhabits another world. And now and again, for reasons that are never very clear, God pops into this world. And some people experience him like, say, an old E.T., you remember that movie? Something harmless, something especially for the kids. or maybe something out of Star Wars, you know, some like an Obi-Wan Kenobi that delivers us from all the Darth Vaders of this world. But in all such instances, there's an occasionalism about the experience, so that you don't know when or where such a divine invasion will occur again. And it's an image which is designed to give you a permanent crick in your neck from always looking over your shoulder, wondering when and where God will pop in next and what form God will take this time around in your life. And it's never very dependable, it seems. Always leaves you wondering why it is that God picked that place and that time, and why God's presence never seems to be, or seldom seems to be, designed to be timed for when you need it most. Or another image is what I would call the Christmas image, where God's world and our world just touch. Normally, God's off in God's own world, but then in Jesus of Nazareth, God, to quote the typical Christmas sermon, entered into our time and history and made it his own. Here, God's world just touches our world, just at the point of the incarnation. And so there is a very limited relationship between God's world and our world, and all the world's experience of God has somehow got to be channeled through that particular historical point. Somehow we've got to clean up our language on this one. The incarnation's not the point at which God entered into time and history and made it his own. The Old Testament witnesses in a massive way to just such divine activity. There needs to be some other sort of image with which we work here. Or a third, which I think is the view of the Hebrew Bible in its most basic sense, at least. And it's captured in that old hymn, "This is my Father's world." Not some other world. This is it. God is at home in this world, not in some special God world. Israel's understanding is such that God is transcendent. God is other than this world, but God is at home in this world. Listen to Jeremiah 23, verse 23 and 24. "Am I a God at hand, says the Lord, and not a God at far off? Can people hide themselves in secret places so that I cannot see them, says the Lord? Do not I," listen to the verb now, "do not I fill heaven and earth?" What does it mean for God, for the world to be full of God? That language is all over the Old Testament. The whole earth is full of his glory. The Old Testament wants to be even more precise. Listen to Psalm 33:5. It's all over the Psalms. "The earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord." God is not just here, if you will. God is always lovingly here. God's love and presence is a factor to be reckoned with wherever there is world. God has a relationship with each and every one, human and non-human alike. And God's love undergirds and informs, indeed drives everything that God does, from nature to history, from creation to the feeding of the animals. So from the Old Testament point of view, I think, God's place is in this world. Where there is world, there's God. The God who is transcendent, who is other than this world, has chosen this world to be home. So God always then works from within the world and not on the world from without. One word about presence, this word presence. We use it oftentimes in a univocal way. It's not very helpful, I think. But let's just take a look at it in terms of human relationships. Sometimes we use the word presence in the sense of there-ness. To be present is to be here, to be there. Yet we do speak of people having a certain presence whose there-ness is more felt and more effective than that of others. Or we do speak of differences in energy level or focus. You know, John really wasn't with us today. I mean, but he's sitting there. or the presence of some persons can make others back off or be less forceful for a variety of reasons. Or, and you know as well as I do, I've been married for some 35 years and have learned this well, that a constancy of intense presence with one another can be stifling and oppressive. What does it mean when we talk about the presence of God? God desires to be as an effective a presence as possible. And that, the way in which we speak about presence will vary. The Old Testament, it varies in the Old Testament. Jonah flees from the presence of the Lord, and then he confesses belief in a creator. Or the psalmist prays, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, to whom is he praying? There's a difference in understanding of presence. There are different intensifications of presence, if you will, with regard to God's presence among us. Generally, one could say that God is continuously present, yet God will also be present in a special way at certain times. Or God is everywhere present, yet God will also be especially present in certain places. I mean, is it not so? God is everywhere, but God will only be found somewhere. I mean, God is eternal, but God is known only at some time. Now let's go to Psalm 139 for a few reflections. This is not a narrowly exegetical piece. This is integrating some expository comments with some contemporary experience. Psalm 139 is a lament. The context is trouble. It's a psalm for the dark seasons of life. Let me take some psalms, some verses, and look at them a little. First, verses 7 to 10. Whither shall I flee from your spirit? Whither shall I flee from your presence? If I climb up to heaven, you're already there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're already there. If I take my flight to the frontiers of the morning or dwell at the limit of the western sea, even there, your hand will meet me and your right hand will hold me fast. We so often reduce God to the God of the Christians, a partisan God, a God of the Christian clan, a God whose only or primary business is to look after the needs of the elect, the Christian people or whatever. We need somehow to recapture this vision of the psalmist, that God is at work in all the world, and that all of God's creatures everywhere have experienced the presence of God. They may not know that they've experienced it, but they have experienced it. All people, all creatures have experienced God, even though they may not realize that fact. And this should have a powerful effect on how we understand mission. We need to find ways to touch base with the experience of God which people have had before we showed up with the Bible in our hands. And that may be, we need to ask a question like this: what experiences of the transcendent might one be able to point to in the lives of people? Maybe the experience of unconditional love. Maybe the experience of humor, of play, rumors of angels, to use Peter Berger's language. Or from another perspective, we think that in order to encounter God or to be truly present with God, we have to somehow escape from the world. And so we escape into monasteries or into a certain type of liturgy or into a certain type of piety, or we flagellate ourselves in some way or another to try to divest ourselves of the world. But the Old Testament insists that being with God does not mean escaping from the world. It's precisely in the world that one meets God and lives with God. That life with God will always mean life in the world, and not in some specific slice of the world or in the gaps of the world. If you would experience God, you must fall in love with the world. If you would image God, you must fall in love with the world, because that's what God does. God's love is specifically directed to this world. Don't look up for God. Look around you. The transcendent one is here, intensely at hand. If you would experience God, go home and look around. If I climb up to heaven, you're already there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're already there. Let's go back to verses 1 to 3. Lord, you have searched me and you've known me. You know when I sit down or rise up. You trace my journeys and my resting places, and you're acquainted with all my ways. How often it is that we associate God's works and ways only with highly special interruptive events. I mean, we single out the Exodus, the conquest, the resurrection, Pentecost, and we use the language of intervention for God, interruption for God, as if God is normally off in another world and now and again pops in with a goodie or a baddie. This notion of God's presence has so permeated our life and thought that we often think that it's only incomparable types of dramatic events that we can somehow discern God's activity and presence among us. And so we go looking for mountaintop experiences, we go looking for miracles, or we feel guilty if we haven't had them, or we can't pray them into being, or we make other people feel guilty because they haven't had them. We need to remember this unrelenting Old Testament insistence that God is present in all the little things that go to make up our days, in my lying down, my sitting. You're acquainted with all my ways. Or from another perspective, we think that if we want God to be active among us, we somehow need to duplicate the biblical situation as far as possible. And so we look for God to duplicate biblical miracles or other extraordinary events, just as God did back then. But God uses what is available in any age as instruments in and through which to work. And it's often the case that the ways and means God uses these days are somewhat different from what they were in biblical times. We just about lost our 23-year-old daughter in May when she was taken to the emergency ward of the hospital late in the night, and her heart rate was 300 beats per whatever it is. How does that go? Her heart was out of control. Fortunately, they were able to bring it back to normal. Up until just a couple of years ago, it would have been called open heart surgery, would have been called for. Now they're working with a new procedure called catheter ablation. And what they did was they put catheters into a number of her arteries and veins and did laser surgery through catheters on the part in her heart that needed correction. She was out of the hospital and back at work within 36 hours. That's a gift of God. Moses' use of Egyptian medical techniques such as snake images, or Jesus' use of spit and clay for that matter, heal the eyes of the blind. Those were means available then. Miracle drugs, skilled eye surgeons, skilled heart surgeons are what God has made available to us today in all kinds of ways that have become commonplace. God is present and at work among us. Let's recapture some of that. Psalm 139 again, verse 19. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God, and that people of blood would depart from me. Oh, we cringe a wee bit at that. We tend to look for God's presence and activity only in those things that are pleasant and inspiring. As we so often think and speak as if God were not present in situations of strife or of war or of suffering or death. Where there's sunshine, there's God, huh? And we have often turned God into a namby-pamby, an indulgent father, a professor who's never critical. That's my problem. But what if God didn't care about evil and its perpetrators? Or what if God cared and didn't do anything about it? What if God was indifferent to evil and to all the Hitlers and Hitler types who roam and ravage in this world? We of all people would be the most to be pitied, for salvation would not then be possible, though we confessed it all day long. Listen to some words of Abraham Heschel. The message, this is from his book, The Prophets, page 284, one volume. The message of wrath is frightful indeed, but for those who have been driven to the brink of despair by the sight of what malice and ruthlessness can do, comfort will be found in the thought that evil is not the end, that evil is never the climax of history. This is the most vexing question in a world where the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper. Does God condone? Does God care for right and wrong? I mean, if the agony of people were a matter of discomfort, a mild condition, then maybe a simple word of divine commiseration would do. But to a generation afflicted by the fury of cruel people, by the outrage of abandoning God, no condemnation is too harrowing. And then he finishes with this kind of stunning language. Our sense of injustice is a poor analogy to God's sense of injustice. The exploitation of the poor is to us a misdemeanor. To God, it's a disaster. Our reaction is disapproval. God's reaction is something that no language can convey. I mean, is it a sign of cruelty, he concludes, that God's anger is aroused when the rights of the poor are violated, or when widows and orphans are oppressed? Finally, verse 13 following. You yourself created my inmost parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. And I love this translation that comes out of the Lutheran Book of Worship translation. I thank you because I am marvelously made. I thank you because I am marvelously made. We so often confine God's presence in the world to those areas that have no other explanation. I mean, the insurance company's act of God. They got it from the church. Be sure of it. I mean, if science and technology cannot provide an explanation for what has occurred, then at that point we can begin to talk about God. On the other hand, if it has a scientific explanation, there's no need to talk about God. And as the various sciences increasingly come to understand the world and how it works, God's presence gets more and more crowded out. And so this language of the psalm about God's involvement in the whole process of conception and gestation and birthing, science got that one pretty well figured out for us, right? But here we see God involved in all the intricacies of the gestation process. Now, it may well be that apart from faith, we can give an intelligible account of such events for a whole variety of purposes, medical research, for example, but the biblical faith would claim that no full account of any event is possible without factoring God into the process. In everything, God is at work for good. Now, from another perspective, we should note in these verses that God is at work in the body. This is not some spiritual experience or some psychical experience. And how often it is that we can find God to working in the spiritual life, the inner life, huh? I'm sure you remember that movie, The Chariots of Fire. about two runners that were preparing for the 1924 Olympics. One of them a Jew, and the other a Christian who became, he was a Scotsman who became a missionary to China. His name was Eric Little. I'll never forget one sentence that he spoke. We saw it in a theater where the reaction to this sentence was sheer laughter, and it occasioned a lot of reflection for me when Eric Little said, "God made me for a purpose. God made me fast." I wonder, I mean, we talk about God in connection with the spiritual and the psychical almost exclusively. Here God is at work in the body. Is God like a seamstress? It's a feminine image for God there. Is God like a seamstress, puts all the patches of the quilt, which is you and me, together? Here God is at work in the natural, amid all those blood vessels and brain waves and bronchial tubes making life possible. The effects of sin do get things botched up now and again. But think where we would be without that surgical work of God. And if we come closer to the church in water and bread and wine, God at work in your body, enabling a new bodily creation of you to emerge and develop, and a mother's comforting arms and a doctor's skillful hands. For you yourself created my inmost parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I thank you because I am marvelously made. All these narrow perspectives about the presence of God which we have occasion innumerable problems for us, as they did for Israel. When, for example, disaster strikes the church or the Christian, when to all appearances God's providential activity on behalf of us has ceased, questions arise. Where in the world is God? Has God left us for other worlds? Does God really care about those whom he's chosen to call his own? Well, the more narrowly we conceive of God's presence in the world, the more vulnerable we are to disappointment and despair when life breaks up around us. And we can't see beyond the church, or we can't see beyond my personal relationship with God. Let me conclude with just some comments on the book of Job, on the end of the book of Job. You recall, of course, the suffering of Job. In the 38th chapter of Job, God appears to Job in a whirlwind. And where does God take Job? God does not take Job up into heaven for a vision of God. God does not take Job into the temple for a nice worship service. God does not take Job on a plunge into the depths of his own soul. But God takes Job to the zoo. Or more precisely, God takes Job out into the wilds of the world. And out there in the wide creation, Job is led to new vistas of God's caring presence. The best illustration I know for that ending of Job is a football illustration. Coach McKay, who used to coach, I think, at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, maybe, and then before that, the University of Southern California football team, the coach of the USC team, following a close defeat on his part of his team in the Rose Bowl, he came into the locker room after some time to find his players sitting there with their heads in their hands in despair over this loss. He stopped and he said just one thing. "Fellas, there are 900 million Chinese people who never even knew we played. There's a world out there. There's a world in which God is present, lovingly present, have we got a vision of it? A little parable to end. It builds off of the Job, the speeches of God at the end of Job. Say, Steve, man of faith, you see that dark cloud over there? Look where the rain is falling, Steve. In that uninhabited wasteland, there are never any people there, Steve, but you should see the flowers in the spring. Say, Lisa, child of faith, over here. Look behind this craggy rock. Do you see that mountain goat? Notice how carefully she is nurturing her young. And look down there at that wild horse. He'll never pull your sleigh through the snow. But notice the way he runs and how he roams so freely. Say, John, child of faith, do you see that ostrich over there? That seems rather dumb, leaving its eggs lie around like that. It's hard for you to understand why God should have made such a creature. I mean, if you were the creator, would you have made an ostrich? I mean, it certainly doesn't fit the pattern of how you might have made the world. But that's the way a lot of things are. Ambiguity, complexity, things just bizarre. Your human perspective on the creation is finally rather limited, John. Sarah, woman of faith, look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? Consider the lilies of the field and how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, will he not much more clothe you? And so Steve and Lisa and John and Sarah, when you get home from school with a broader vision of God's caring presence in the world, then you may be able to hear with even greater clarity that God is present with you and for you wherever you are. And when you journey through the valley of the shadow of death, and you will, you know, remember God's presence of closeness, that in those times, God will be near you. God will never leave you nor forsake you. You can count on that. Thank you very much.
With Steve and John and Sarah and Lisa, we thank you.